Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers and I'm here with my co-host Gail Schimmel, who tells me she has not had much of a writing week this week.
Just out me immediately, Fiona. If I was thinking about lying about it, I can't now. But no, I haven't. I have managed a few hundred words here and there. I have felt frustrated by it. I have felt upset that I'm not writing. But the reality is I've had a hard week in other areas of my life. And I think I need to remind myself, sometimes we can't do it. Sometimes a few hundred words is actually a great achievement, just touching the work. I've got a feeling I said exactly the same thing last week. But I will get there, Fiona. I promise you, by the time we speak again, I will have written more than 100 words. Please tell me you've done better.
I have. I've been sticking to my word goal every day. And
I hate you.
It's amazing to me how just getting those words under your belt just turns it into a good day. Mm. And how when you can't do it, the whole day is ruined. Mm. Well, for me, it is. My mood is then a little bit scratchy, a little bit off for the whole day. Mm. Oh, I don't know what it is. It makes me think that this writing thing is a compulsion for some of us.
Fiona, do you think it's because we are quite A-type-driven people who want to meet our goals? Or do you think it's because we haven't had that pleasure, the pleasure that writing is in the day, and that's what we're missing, that we haven't had our fix of going into a strange world?
I think it is both. Having written gives me a kind of peace for the rest of the day. It's just a box that's been ticked. It's the only area in my life in which I am a bit A-type, and I do really try very hard to meet my goals. But it's just a peace and feeling in harmony with the world, and writing is my only way of achieving it.
Me too, it would seem. So I'm not in peace or in harmony with the world. But I'll get there. I'll get there.
Have you been reading or watching anything lately that has made you feel okay with the world?
Yes. I've read the new Marion Keys.
Ooh, yum, yes.
My favorite mistake. So I was clever enough to pre-order it on Kindle, and then, you know, at the first sign you have that it's there is a mysterious amount goes off your bank account, and you have no idea what it is, and you think someone's committed Amazon fraud, and then you realize that you have a lovely new book. And I loved it. You know, I am a Marion Keys fan, and I probably would love anything she wrote. Mm-hmm. You know, she'd have to be pretty darn crappy for me to not enjoy it. But this one I loved particularly because the characters are older now. And Marion tends to write, I think, about characters about 10 years younger than she is at the time of writing, which is perfect for me because I am 10 years younger than her.
Yes.
And she's writing about characters. The main character in this is Anna Walsh, who we have seen before in Is There Anybody Out There, which is my favorite Marion Keys. So that was already a pleasure. And then I see you pulled a face. You will tell me why you pulled a face.
Is that the one where the husband has died?
Yes.
It was so sad and distressed me so greatly. That's why it's not my favorite.
Okay.
And I also acknowledge that it's a brilliant book and I did read it.
Okay.
But wow, that was a hard read.
So I loved that and I was happy to see Anna Walsh again and the Walsh Sister Shenanigans, and it's full of that, you know, it's full of that real Keys Irish madness. But it also has, because the main character is 48, menopause, which is a subject very close to my heart at the moment. And another trope that I love, the moving to a new village and starting a new life trope.
Lovely.
And I really do love that. So I found it very, very satisfying. I read, it's a whop of a book, you know, it's a 600 page thing, and I read it in a few days, and I really did love it. I tried to drag it out towards the end because
I
was
loving
it so
much. That you lied about trying to eke it out. Meanwhile, you weren't eking, you were gobbling.
I was eking. That's the sad part, because it's such a gobble of a read that had I gobbled how I wanted to, it would have been done in a day. But I stopped myself and I paced myself a bit, so it took a few days. So bad writing week, wonderful reading week. What about you?
Well, I watched a movie which is absolutely haunting me, and it's called The Zone of Interest. It was one of the Oscar movies and was a kind of joint production between the Germans and the Polish and Americans. It's all in German, so, you know, you have to have your subtitles on. It's set not in Auschwitz. It's set in the home of a commandant who is in charge of the Auschwitz prison camp. And Auschwitz is happening over the wall, on the other side of the wall. And it's just about the daily life of this commandant and his family. And they go on picnics and they go paddling on the river and the children go to school and there are servants in the home and they have their meals and it's all just a very, very ordinary life. And on the other side of the wall, you hear things and you see things and you look at the people who are working in the house and you think, where have they come from? And the wife gets a shipment of clothes that has just come in. And she and her friends are so excited to try on the clothes. And she tries on a fur coat and she parades in front of the mirror. And she reaches into the pocket because she feels something there. And she pulls out a lipstick, which has been used almost down to the stub. And you see her in the mirror trying on this lipstick. And you know where these clothes have come from. And you know who they used to belong to. And just that awareness of what's going on the other side of the wall, it haunts me. I watched this quite a few days ago and it has stayed with me. It disturbed my sleep. I know it doesn't sound like I'm recommending it, but it is one of the most remarkable movies I've ever seen.
Not going to watch it for all the tea in China. Absolutely not going to watch it. It sounds, Fiona, a little bit like Boy in the Striped Pajamas, those opening scenes of Boy in the Striped Pajamas, where the family's living their life with the people from the concentration camp working in the house.
Yes, yes, it is similar to that. And I know people have criticized Boy in the Striped Pajamas for sort of the way it turns out being a bit improbable, that couldn't really have happened. This is so realistic and the period details and the hairstyles, everything is so absolutely accurate and realistic. It chilled me to the bone. So to anyone listening who wants a challenging watch.
Who wants to be chilled to the bone.
Yes, if you want to be chilled to the bone, I cannot recommend it enough, honestly.
Thank you, Fiona. I know what I will not be watching. My bones are sufficiently chilled, but it does sound remarkable.
And speaking of remarkable, that is a very good word to describe our guest today. Our guest today is Ivan Vladislavich. Ivan is an author, he occupies the position of Distinguished Professor in Creative Writing at Wits University at the moment. Ivan is the author of such works of fiction as The Folly, The Restless Supermarket, The Exploded View, and also of memoirs such as Portrait with Keys and The Near North. Ivan, thank you for your time and welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me.
Ivan, we're going to leap right into it. How has your writing week been?
My writing week has not been good from the point of view of actual writing, so which I've not done much of, but I have been busy with the stuff that goes on around writing, doing a bit of preparation for interviews. I have a seminar, online seminar about The Distance, which was my last novel, on Saturday morning. So I've been refamiliarizing myself with that because, believe it or not, you don't keep your entire novel in your head forever. So I've been doing a bit of prep for that. And then otherwise occupied with university work this week. So I've had a week that's not immediately productive, but that goes to grease the wheels of having a writing career.
And as I was just saying, sometimes you have to accept that you just can't get to the writing. There are weeks where it doesn't happen. But what does it look like for you when you're in full flow? You write, you deep in a work, what does your writing week look like then?
And your daily writing process as well.
Right. Well, if I'm in a good place where I can do this, then I can write every day. And that's, I think that's the ideal. So, and I'm not a morning person. So I tend to do mulling around a bit in the morning, preparatory mulling around, desk tidying and stuff like that.
Important.
Very important part of the process. Sharpening my pencils because I write with a pencil and then kind of getting ready to write.
We've got to stop writing.
Yes.
Can we talk about writing with a pencil? Right. You write with a pencil.
I do write with a pencil.
Into a
with many pencils. I mean, in a row.
Into a notebook.
I write on A4 sheets of paper but I do write in pencil. Initial drafting, anyway.
And who transcribes it onto a screen for you?
I do. Mm-hmm. I do. Yeah.
And do you do it in batches? You can see we're fascinated. This is a new process for us. Do you do it like write today's work and transcribe it, or do you write the whole book?
No, I write the whole book. I try and stay on the page for as long as possible. And I know it sounds incredibly antiquated, but part of it is that I started out writing that way, as I've been writing for a long time. And part of it is a somewhat superstitious belief that that process works for me. I'm quite a messy writer. I'm quite an obsessive reviser. And, I find that when I'm working on a page for purely practical reasons, there's a limit to how much rewriting and revision you can do.
Mm-hmm.
So, at some point, perhaps 20 years ago, I tried to shift over to writing on screen and just found that I was endlessly tinkering and creating options. So I just ended up with an unworkable manuscript. So I went back to writing on the page, which allows me to keep that very fluid, messy process somewhat under control, and then tidy it up by transferring a more readable, coherent version onto your computer.
So then you almost do an edit as you transcribe. So do work in that reworking in that process.
Exactly. Yeah. Having to type it up at some point forces me to make decisions about what I'm actually going to go with, rather than keeping a whole lot of options visible. And I suppose that's also part of the motivation, is having the different possibilities, including the initial one, the initial instinctive expression, still available on the page. Mm. In other words, not edited away and vanished.
Mm.
And even when I'm editing digital copy and I obsessively keep versions, I find that it's very difficult to go back on a digital proof and see what you said before. There's some managing it all is much more difficult for me anyway than managing a handwritten draft.
Mm. It's almost like that textbook thing I found it very hard to work on a digital textbook because you can't just flip back and check.
Yeah. And there's something as well about the sort of actual physical experience of writing, which for me, because I didn't grow up with digital technology, actually holding a pencil and writing on paper feels somehow more natural, in the sense that it's natural to me to do that. I don't have to think about it. I'm not a touch typist. So actually just being able to write is a little bit closer. Writing by hand is like a little bit closer to, I don't know, drawing or some other feels a bit more expressive. And, you know, I realize this sounds nonsensical to people who don't work this way, but that's how it is.
It actually sounds lovely. Ivan, I know you've worked as an editor. The final draft that you will submit for another editor to look at, is it squeaky clean? Have you really cleaned it up to a great extent, or do you submit a fairly messy draft that needs quite a bit of work?
I tend to submit very finished work. Mm-hmm. I do have a few people who read for me along the way, so trusted readers. Mm-hmm. And that's a sort of changing set of people. But I try to produce a fairly clean, what I think of as resolved, in inverted commas, resolved text, and get people to read that for me. And then I tidy that up and revise on the basis of what those readers say. And then try to get to a publisher something that I think is pretty clean. But squeaky clean, no. I mean, it's never.
Mm.
That's the great thing about having editors, and why that process is so important, is that no matter how clean you think that the text is, there are always things that could be different. They're not necessarily wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But when another person reads and another mind comes to what you've done, there are always possibilities you haven't thought about, or you always have blind spots about certain things, and then you can always change it.
Do you enjoy the editing process?
I do, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been very much part of my working life. I worked for nearly 30 years as an editor, as a freelancer, which takes some doing, if I may say so myself. So I do enjoy it. I think it's I get a fair amount of satisfaction out of doing that tidying up and getting things right. You know, I like doing a consistency check on the text to make sure that I've done things in the same way. It's kind of clerical. It's the clerical side of my character, shall we say.
So you don't feel any defensiveness when you open a manuscript and an editor's worked on it and they're just notes and red ink everywhere. You don't feel a sense of, you know, just have
maybe,
to
maybe
breathe.
Maybe he doesn't have all those notes on red ink that we get.
Maybe not. But do you fight back with editors at all ever?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's true. I haven't had too many texts that were heavily edited,
mm-hmm.
Because I do a lot of that work myself. I actually do the consistency checking and all of that. I think initially when the first time I had a very strong editor, I was alarmed,
mm-hmm.
because of course you always think that you're better than you are.
Which book was that?
I had a very strong American editor work on parts of Portrait with Keys.
Mm-hmm.
So until then, I think I'd had quite careful but light editing,
mm-hmm.
technically very good editing, but not editing of the more invasive kind, mm-hmm. or the more creative kind,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I had an American editor who worked on some texts I published in Granta. I can say who he is. He's Matt Weiland. He was, I think, later the fiction editor at the Paris Review.
Oh.
He's a very experienced, very good editor. And he just, he didn't have any sense that he had to, you know, tread carefully. And that was the first time that I can recall being really alarmed and kind of upset. It was like, what's he doing? You know, he didn't work into the text that much, but he had very strong ideas about how the final text should look.
Mm-hmm.
So he did things like I was working with headings on each of the sections of the text. He just took them out and said, don't need them. And I was very attached to them. So it was that kind of thing. And he just said, no, I know you've published parts of this in the sequence before, but it's not working, so we'll just turn it all around. So he did that kind of structural editing, which I also love doing to other writers, you see. But I did accept the edit, and I try as much as possible not to argue with the editor. I'll argue if it's something that I feel very strongly about.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's something that I even think, well, I wouldn't do it that way, but I can see why you might want to do it that way, I will try to live with the editing, because I think otherwise it's pointless. Mm. If you argue with your editor about everything, you're just negating the entire purpose of it, which is in the end just for another sensibility to filter the text in a particular way, and hopefully in a sort of consistent way or in a coherent way. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily the right way. It just means it's another way.
Mm.
And sometimes that other way improves everything. Mm. Right? So I try not to argue.
I want us to take a step back, and I want to ask you, were you that child who always wanted to write, or is writing something that you came to another way? Give us your superhero origin story. How did you come to write? And I want you to throw in how somebody with your very exotic name came to be in South Africa. I'm interested in like, I want you to go back before your birth in the superhero origin story.
Well, shall we start with the name? So, my father had Croatian background. He was born in South Africa, but his parents were both immigrants who came to South Africa in the, around 1920s, so just after the First World War.
Okay.
I don't know very much about the family history, but presumably left Europe after the devastations of the war and the collapse of the old order. So they ended up in Pretoria. My father was born there, so that's the Croatian surname. My mother's side of the family are largely Irish and English. And well, it's a bit, she's got a slightly more mixed up lineage, Irish and English and German. But her, yeah. So that's how I ended up in Pretoria. And the writing, I am one of those children who wanted to write from a very young age. So I was a big reader when I was young. All the usual suspects of that era, which is the, it had been the '60s, the early '60s, and Just William, those kind of things, the William books, the Hardy Boys, but also random reading off the very small family bookshelf, which is things like Wuthering Heights, you know, Dickens, Great Expectations, books that I read when I actually had no real clue what they were about. So I come from a reading family, but not a sort of, and I don't come from an educated family, so I had no real guidance on what to read. It was just hit and miss, things I discovered at school, in the school library, or just found out for myself somehow. And I loved writing as a child, so I loved writing compositions, and that sort of, that side of schoolwork was always exciting. And I knew from a relative, it always sounds pretentious to say this, but I knew from a relatively young age that if I had to do something with my life, I would like to write. Before I even knew what it entailed, I just knew that it was actually based on reading, right? Because based on the sense that that the writers were having even more fun than everyone else, because they were making these things up. And I had this, it's a strange thing to, I think I have spoken about it once, perhaps in an interview, but I had a kind of excitement about writing, which has been difficult to recapture. The longer I've written, it's got harder and harder to recapture an almost physical excitement about doing it, which I think I've spoken privately to other writers, and they recognize this from when they were young, this feeling that when you're writing something even as a young child, you're making something up. There's a certain energy that's generated in you. That's it's quite a mysterious excitement that has to do with creating something, with making something.
And when you're not making something up, when you are writing from your life in memoir, is there less excitement in that process than in fiction writing? Or can you bring that excitement to bear?
I think they are a bit different. There are moments which they don't come that that often, I suppose. But there are moments writing fiction where things take flight. Mm-hmm. And that's what you look, that's in a way, I guess, sort of a lot of writerism should, but, well, I hope that both of you have had that experience where you're working, you feel like you're working in some hard, logical, difficult way. You're trying to get something down. You're trying to go forward because that's what you do. Mm. You're writing. You're spending the day writing. And then there are those moments where something suddenly happens, that something just begins to fire in your imagination and you're not really in control of it. And that's, I guess that's partly where that sort of primal excitement comes from, is that something begins to arise that's coming from you, but it's not exactly you doing it in that conscious way. And then there's no telling what can happen. And I think it is more likely that will happen writing fiction, where the possibilities are boundless in a way, as opposed to writing memoir, where you're always tied somehow to what actually happened.
A dragon cannot arrive in a memoir.
But depends who's writing the memoir. I can imagine a few where dragons would arrive repeatedly. But
I'm interested in you talking about that feeling of creative energy and it dissipating over time. You teach writing. How do you teach people, do you teach people to access that creative energy, to feel that excitement? Or do you think most people who come to study creative writing already know that?
That's an interesting question. I think most people who come to, or some people who come to study creative writing have had that experience. And some people who come would like to give themselves the possibility, the option of having that, or they would like to do it. They would like to have that. They would like to give themselves permission to do it. Some people who study relatively late in life, some people who study relatively late in life are people who always wanted to write, but something's got in the way. Always wanted to write a novel, wanted to write even a nonfiction book. They've worked all their lives as journalists or in some other related field, but they've never been able to actually get the book done. And some of that has to do with practical things of earning a living and so on. And some of it has to do with not having the application to do it. And some of it has to do with just not finding the particular switch in you that, which is, says, I'm entitled to do this. Mm-hmm. I can, you know, I have something to say, which writers grapple with. It's like, is this important to anyone else? I mean, it's interesting to me, or it's important to me, but you have to somehow believe that it's worth doing and putting out into the world and expect other people to take it seriously or get interested in it. So I think in the writing program, the situation is a teaching one. And I think that's something I had to kind of come to myself, is understanding that you're trying to teach people something about the process. And so you can't expect it to be exactly the way it is if you were just doing it on your own. So we do a lot of, very careful, sometimes nitpicking reading of what the writers are doing. And we go over that and we make visible and conscious things that might well be left alone if you were just doing it on your own, if you were just writing a novel on your own. We try to show them what they're doing in their work so that they understand some of that, and then they're able to get a kind of broader or deeper sense of what writing is. And then hopefully at some later point, all of that conscious thinking about how it works will get submerged again, and they will be able to write in a more instinctive way, but with a better foundation. So having said that, I think we still encourage them to try and write freely, and then before they bring it to a seminar and expect other people to read it, you know, look at what they've done and try and just – tidy it up a bit, actually work on it. It's been important for me to understand that this is not a writing workshop of the kind that people go to where they go to a retreat and they all write and that's the purpose of it.
Mm.
It's actually a teaching environment and you're trying, and so you have different requirements and you have different goals.
And I'm very curious, sorry, do you have people who come out of it, you know, I presume everyone goes into it thinking, I have a book in me that needs to come out, as all of us as writers meet so many people who tell us about that book they have in them. Do some of them come to the end of it and go, you know what, I don't have a book in me, as it turns out?
Mm-hmm.
Or do most people who go through a creative writing program manage to get the book out?
In my experience, just casting my mind back now, I mean, occasionally there's someone who doesn't complete the program, who finds it too difficult, or who for one reason or another, personal reasons, doesn't finish it. But generally speaking, people do finish the course and they do produce a readable draft of a book, which is the aim. It's not to produce a publishable book, which is also something of a misconception, because it's a teaching experience, actually a learning experience for them. The aim is to get to something that someone else can read, and that gives the student a sense of, this is what you need to go through to arrive at a manuscript. You need to work regularly. You need to think about what you're doing. You need to edit afterwards. You know, those kinds of things. And we hope that there will be a publishable product at the end, but it's not necessarily the case. It might be a very good book that's not publishable. Right? Very good in the sense of it fulfills what they set out to do. I think what does happen sometimes is that having a book in you and wanting to write is sometimes a kind of quite specific thing for people. And once they do it, it satisfies that need. There might be people who only have one book in them, okay, or there might be people who simply had to show themselves that they could write a book and then be a writer in that sense. But I think, I mean, as working writers yourselves, you'll know that actually writing the second book is generally harder than writing the first one. Writing the third one doesn't get easier. People think it gets easier. It gets easier in the sense that you might know more about what you're doing, and you might have a clearer sense of where you're going with it all. But actually doing it, every time you have to write a book, you have to go through the same difficult process. And that's, I think, a different need. Actually wanting to write like that, wanting to write as a way of life.
Wanting to do it again and again.
Do it again and again.
That's suffer again and again.
It's different. And of course, if you become successful and you start making money, then there's a different set of things enter into it. Then you're making a living and you're successful on that level. But that also doesn't happen as a matter of course. So mainly what you're doing is trying to find a way to keep doing something that's really important to you, even though it's difficult.
I noticed in your most recent memoir, The Near North, that you mention other writers, international writers, but particularly South African writers, and you kind of synthesize their words into your musings. And I just made a note of a few of them, Nadine Gordimer, Lionel Abrams, Peter Wilhelm, Henrietta Rose Innes, Peter Godwin, John Berger. Is that how your mind works? Do you have the words of other writers continually informing your own observations, or do you have to kind of reverse engineer it into your text?
I have thought about this particular question. No one's asked me the question, but I've thought about it a lot, about that particular aspect of the book. I think I don't generally work that way, but I am aware whenever I'm writing that there are, you know, a host of other writers and artists and filmmakers and other makers of cultural things, like looking over my shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that all of the reading one does doesn't disappear. You might not be the kind of person who can pluck a quote from out of the air and, you know, quote a passage from this or a passage from that, but it's all in there. All of the reading that you do from when you're very young, I think it creates that sort of sediment that allows you to write what you do. And it's, I don't think it's possible to unravel it all. But what I did want to do in this book, because the book is a kind of, it takes a walk through parts of Johannesburg and so on. But I also tried to take a walk through some of my own reading influences and writing influences. Mm-hmm. And I think that's mainly what those things are doing there. So they partly, I think, trying to make visible some of the writing that's been important to me, but not all of it. Because it's highly selective. You know, I could probably find another set of writers. If I shifted the focus of the book a little, I could find another set of writers that would play that role. So I'm very aware that there are writers who are enormously important to me that are not in the book. So it's not a definitive set of influences, if you like. It's something like a kind of index of my affinities with certain writers. And I think what holds them together as a set of references is, on the one hand, there's Johannesburg writers, so the writers like Wilhelm and Lionel Abrams and Gordimer, the some of the writers that were important when I was starting to write, and then the other set, I think, are more, they're hopefully guides in a way to how to read the book. So Berger, for instance, is or Pyrrhic. Or Galeano, Eduardo Galeano is one of my favorite writers. It's not so much the tone of the work, it's the way that it's assembled. It's the way that it's put together. They're all writers who write in a sort of collage mode. You can put fragments together. Galeano wrote three extraordinary books about Latin American history that are assemblies of hundreds of stories. And it's all in short pieces, and all the whole meaning of it is in the assembly, how they work against one another rather than as a kind of continuous story. And I think not all of Berger's work is like that, but the particular work that I refer to is also a book like that. I think it draws on the sort of history of notebooks and then it has an assembly of fragments to make a larger meaning. So I think that's sort of what some of those references are about.
The near north of your latest book is the only near north that matters to me, the near north of Johannesburg. I'm a Joburg girl through and through, and clearly Johannesburg for you is very meaningful. Talk to us about your Johannesburg, just why you felt this need to write about it, because this is not the first time you've written about it.
I didn't grow up in Johannesburg, so I'm not born and bred Joburg. Mm. I grew up in Pretoria and came to Johannesburg when I came to study at Wits. So the city was always there to be discovered. And I think and I've only realized this in retrospect, that it shaped my whole orientation towards Johannesburg, was that it wasn't the place that I already knew.
Mm.
It was a place I had to find out about. So I think that sense of discovery, I can see is present even in my very early work, which doesn't obviously appear to be about Johannesburg. My first sort of story collection, there are a couple of pieces that are quite predictive of this kind of writing. Mm. Or I didn't realize that at the time at all. And I've mentioned a few of them in this book also for that reason. There's a particular story called Autopsy, which describes a walk through Hillbrow. But the story itself is a kind of surreal story about following Elvis Presley through Hillbrow. But actually, the substance of the story in some ways is about the places and the shops and the people and the street names and the slogans in the windows. It's very documentary in a certain way. And I think in retrospect, I can see that that's where this sort of interest came from. Mm. It's just trying to capture what's there.
Mm.
And Choburg has always, it's just stayed that way for me. And I've kind of felt a need to, I didn't have to decide to set writing here. It just happened.
But do you think it's you? Do you think wherever you'd gone, you would have had this interest in the city around you? Or do you think there's something about Joburg that stimulates a writer?
I think if I had gone to live somewhere else, as some of my friends did, gone to go and live in New York or London or something, I would have probably ended up writing in a similar way about the city, because I'm interested in that. But I don't think it would have had anything like the meaning for me. And I think in that sense, it is specifically Johannesburg. You know, it's, I'm just thinking now, something that Gordimer said, I don't think Gordimer is my prime influence at all. I've never thought of it that way, but I've been thinking lately about her grasp on the city, her grasp on this place. And she said in her Nobel Prize lecture, she said, being here, and I'm going to mess it up, I'm sure, but she said something like, being here in this time and place, that is the key question for the writer. That's the key issue that has a bearing on the writing, is being here in this time at this place. And I think that's, it's kind of, it feels obvious in a way, but it's not really obvious to a lot of artists or a lot of writers. And she felt very strongly that she had to try and express that very specific individual sense of being in a particular place. So I think, and then this, the book is sparked by having moved from one part of Johannesburg to another and finding myself in a part of Johannesburg that wasn't my natural habitat, and having to adjust to that, having to figure out what's interesting. I always, I always lived on the eastern side of Joburg, and moving to the north is quite a difficult thing for me. It felt like I was moving to the posh side of town, which is ridiculous because I used to spend most of my time on the posh side of town anyway. But I
thought you were going to say it's ridiculous. It's not the posh side of town, but you're owning it. It is the posh side of town.
Well, we're in Randburg now, so that's probably true.
Ivan, you mention in the memoir your friend Dave, and I am pretty sure that you are talking about my old history teacher, Dave Edwards. Right. That's right.
Yes, that is right.
So he taught me history, and he taught Johnny Steinberg. We were in class together. Yeah. And I've follow him. I've been following his career. Yeah. And he is a photographer now. He documents what he calls the deindustrialization of Johannesburg. And he doesn't seek out the beautiful sunsets, the beautiful moments. He seeks out the decay and the things that other people look away from. Would you see your words as in any way a companion piece to his images, or do you have a more sort of optimistic way of constructing your narrative?
That's an interesting question. Dave and I have known one another for a long time. We were at university together.
Uh-huh.
And we were neighbors in Troyville when I lived on the edge of Kensington, the Kensington-Troyville border. Dave was literally a block away. And so we spent many years, more than 20 years, living in the same neighborhood. But I think the similarity, you were asking about the similarity between the two versions of Johannesburg. I suppose when I was writing Portrait with Keys, Johannesburg was in that period when it was changing very quickly. And some of those changes were definitely for the good and were fantastic. There was such a fantastic energy in the city in those years, in the sort of 90s. And I think that's reflected in a certain, what you might call an optimism in my own work. Dave has started taking photographs at a time when the city is really decaying and when there are really massive problems in things like the transport system. Mm-hmm. So he's taken a set of pictures about the rails. For instance, during the pandemic, he was photographing the fairly systematic dismantling of the railway system, yeah, and going to all of these places. And I think, although he himself is I think by nature, hopeful person, he's the kind of person who would start a public garden, mm-hmm, at a time when most people would say, don't bother. So he's that kind of person. But I think he has immersed himself in a side of the city that is distressing. And he sees a lot of the very difficult parts of Johannesburg, the parts of Johannesburg, let's put it this way, that are very difficult for the people living in them. Mm. And I think that's colored his view. So by comparison, I think, this book of mine, which reflects my move to the north and grappling with that, and although it tries to reflect on the appalling inequality in the city, which is a large part of our problem, it's somewhat modulated by my experience. Whereas I think Davis has gone to look at things that, as you say, most people are not looking at.
The Near North is very much a COVID book. A lot of us are not feeling ready to write about COVID yet. We're still too sensitive about it. We're trying to pretend it never happened. I want to know, first of all, what made you brave enough to go there now? What made you feel ready to go there now? And also, how was writing for you during COVID?
Well, to answer the second part, I did a lot of writing in that period. I mean, it was actually suited writers quite well. I know a few writers who didn't feel like getting back to the real world afterwards. But I mean, there was something quite liberating about just having a bit of space, to not having the usual social distractions and being able to work, as appalling as the situation was. So I did a lot of writing. I did writing on this book and also on lots of other things which are still in progress. So it was time for me to just reassess a little bit what I was doing and just have some space. Mm. I didn't intend to write about COVID though. That was a strange thing, because I was writing during that period as a way of processing what was happening, but I didn't think I was writing for publication. So I was keeping a sort of journal of the plague, as I think many people were. Some people with a different orientation were blogging and putting it all out there immediately. I was writing for myself and thinking this will be useful one day, because I also thought, well, there's no point in writing about this now. Mm. But people have read enough about it. They've all lived through it. And then what happened was I started working on a few other texts in that same period, and one of them was about walking. So I was commissioned to write an essay for a more academic publication on walking and its relationship to my creative process. And I started using some of that COVID material, because quite a lot of it turned out to be about walking. It's about the experience of the city when everyone was suddenly out there and the streets are full of people walking because they could only go out, you know, for an hour or two a day. And then I found that somehow, as the books began to morph, the book I thought I was working on, which was some kind of follow-up to Portrait with Keys, began to morph under the influence of the walking material. And I started writing about, I went back to Dave's garden, and, you know, a whole lot of things just kind of coalesced. And it felt to me that it was possible to put some of the COVID material into that framework. There was a context for it so that it wasn't a book about COVID.
Mm.
But it's a book that COVID sort of comes and goes in the way that it did. So that's what I hope the effect of it is anyway, that there's that it registers that moment without being an attempt to analyze it or capture it in some complete way. So that's how that material ended up there. I was quite surprised myself.
Oh, COVID.
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting thing, I think, if you do a certain kind of writing that you don't, that it will become apparent what you're doing as you go along rather than it will be evident from the beginning.
Which actually leads me to one of my questions is, how mindful are you? You sit down to start a project, you go, now I'm going to write a novel, or now I'm going to write a memoir, or now I'm going to write an academic piece, or do you feel your way into the material and then discover?
I think I usually know whether it's a novel or not. I mean, that I usually know whether I'm writing a piece of fiction, although some people would probably disagree. Sometimes like the book turns out pretty much what I thought I was going to do, and sometimes it goes off in a different direction.
As Gail and I have been interviewing authors, particularly those who have written memoirs, I've been refining my thinking about memoir, and it seems that there are different kinds of memoir. There's the memoir where the author had an interesting life and is going to tell you about it, or the author did an interesting thing, like maybe went to the Olympics or whatever, and is going to tell you about that. Or an interesting thing happened to the author. Maybe they got kidnapped by Boko Haram and are telling you about that. And then there's, I would say, your kind of memoir, which is, I thought about things in an interesting way. And for that kind of memoir, how do you decide what the beginning and the end of the story are going to be? Because you have to make a choice. You have to decide, I will start here and I will end there. And with the Near North, what kind of informed those starting and ending points?
I was working with two time frames. So that's sort of kept the material in the present contained.
Mm-hmm.
And that time frame is more or less the period of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
So most of what happens in that, in the unfolding present, is confined to that. And I actually had the opportunity to extend the book. You know, I could have added another year's worth of experience onto the end because the book took a while to get into print.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided not to. So I haven't, you know, I was tempted to update some of this mad stuff that happened in Johannesburg, like the streets exploding and things like that. But then I thought, well, it falls outside of the time frame. So I had the material in the present was sort of contained by that. And then the main thing that happens in the past is the garden, is Dave's garden. So I had those two sort of poles to work with, and the book is really moving between those two worlds. The decision about how to structure the book, I actually had a more symmetrical structure, if I could put it that way. And this is where having readers that you trust is so valuable, because I think I'd fallen into a pattern which I replicated with the manuscript, of feeling that I had to balance the beginning and the end, and the things had to have there to be some kind of symmetry, because I had such a strong thing in the middle, the gardening section, the Dave's garden section. I felt that I needed to bookend the text. And so there's two scenes that are walking, where the narrator is walking with Minky, and they're talking about walking and picking things up in the street and doing other things. And initially the book is bookended by those two episodes.
Okay.
And my reader said to me, if you read the book and you push through to the end, you finally know who everybody is and you meet everyone, and so it's fine. But the reader's going to have to stick with this, because you're only really introducing the main characters, you know, 40 pages in. And they said to me, you need to find a way to introduce the themes of the book and the main characters earlier. And that involved me scrambling up that symmetry that I had, which is an end is a false thing anyway. What is it? That's just a pattern. And so I shifted the book now opens with a scene about load shedding. I shifted that to the beginning because it's atmospheric and I think a lot of readers will respond to it. And then I created the second section, what I think of as the second chapter, which introduces Minky and Dave and the setting and so on. And then the rest of the book more or less unfolds the way I intended it to. So if the book has a structure now that keeps somebody reading, it's thanks to my perceptive readers, who editors essentially, who pointed out that I was assuming too much.
Interesting.
So this is more of a quick question. If you had to choose what sort of legacy you leave the world, and also if you had to choose what you would want people to be doing, would you plant a garden or write a book? And what would you like to see more people doing?
Oh, Fiona, what a question.
I would like to write a book, definitely. But hopefully a book that encourages people to plant gardens, which I think I may have done.
Perfect. I love that answer. So we come to our last question that we like to ask people, which is, what have you been reading or listening to or watching lately that's made an impression on you?
I've been doing a lot of reading lately that for very particular purposes, so somewhat directed reading. So I'm not going to say anything about that. But I think the writer that I would like to talk about, the book I'd like to talk about, is something that I read actually towards the end of last year by a writer called Morabo Morochele, and it's called Three Egg Dilemma, and it's published by Jacana. And I just think it's a fantastic book. He's a very interesting writer. He's only published two books. He published a book called How We Buried Pussel in about 20 years ago, which I loved when I read it, and I actually thought, here comes a writer, here comes a novelist. And he actually hasn't written anything again until now. The book is set, both of them are set in Lesotho, and it's a version of Lesotho, although I don't think he ever mentions Lesotho by name. They're both stories about, well, the first one is about a book that was written 20 years ago, but the first book is about an exile who comes back to Lesotho and has to bury his brother, and it's about what happens around the funeral. The new one, which was published last year, is it takes place during a military coup, which is obviously based on what happened in Lesotho, the sort of military takeover, and it concerns a main character who is a guy who rents out rooms in his property, and it's him and the set of people around him and how they survive under this military regime. And it's an extraordinary book for me for many reasons. He has an extraordinarily vivid language, and he's one of those writers that a writer in the sense of he's remaking things in language. He's remaking the world. It's a version of the world that you just don't otherwise see or know. So he has it's quite poetic. The prose is quite poetic, but it's also very visceral and very connected to the world and to the gritty stuff in the world. And I think this is also interesting to me, it's a book about poverty, about being poor, what it actually means to be poor, to be hungry, and how you survive in those conditions. I really love it. I think this is a wonderful book, and I don't think he's had as much attention as he deserves, partly because, to go back to our earlier conversation, he doesn't have that sustained literary presence where he's producing a book every few years. Mm. And he's wrote one novel, disappeared. I don't know where he's been. He's a musician, apparently. I know very little about him, but I think he's a musician by trade. And now, sort of 20 years later, another book. And that, I think, to sustain a readership and get real interest from, you know, the various institutions that need to take an interest in you, the press, the academy, and so on, it's difficult if you're not writing consistently and making a career of it. Mm. And I think that's a great shame.
I must tell you, you have seen, I've been smiling while you're talking, because I actually heard him speak at Kingsmead last year. He is absolutely charming. Like, I fell slightly in love with him. He is an absolutely charming man. He has a way about him. That thing you said about his language is in his spoken language as well. I can't remember when last I've been so utterly charmed by a person. So very interesting. And I think I saw that he is on the menu, so to speak, for one of the festivals this year. I'm not sure which one, but I have seen him on the menu again.
And cool. I get the sense that the Three Egg Dilemma is gaining momentum in the social media space. I've been reading about it and seeing stuff about it. So hopefully he will get the recognition he deserves soon.
I'm glad to hear that.
Well, Ivan, thank you so much for your time. We hope everyone checks out The Near North, which is published by Pan Macmillan, and also is tempted to go back into your backlist and perhaps read Portrait with Keys or The Restless Supermarket, where you also deal with Johannesburg as a kind of character in the novel.
And I'm going to add to that, I saw someone on social media the other day saying that they struggled to get hold of The Near North.
I
find it very strange. So I just want to point out to listeners that, especially with a new book like this, if it's not in your bookshop, just ask the guys to order it and they will order it quickly. It's not a great mystery how to get hold of a book like this. It's a very easy process. Thank you, Ivan.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Gail, Ivan is a very likable person. Would you agree with me?
He really is. And, you know, I wasn't sure if that was going to be the case. You know, sometimes we know a lot about the personality of someone we're going to interview. And in this case, I didn't know. I hadn't met Ivan before. Mm-hmm. I knew of Ivan, obviously, but I hadn't met him before. And he really is. He's got a lovely energy.
What did you take out of what he said?
So it's interesting, you know, often people ask why we write, especially when they discover that it does not make us anything approaching millionaires. And they say, well, then why do you bother? And something Ivan said kind of made me think, well, maybe this is actually what it is. And it's when he said that when he was a child and he was reading and it was so wonderful to read, and it felt to him like the writers were having more fun than even the readers were. And I think maybe that is why writers write, that it is actually a lot of fun and it is even more fun than reading. And it was almost a reminder to me, this is what it's about. Come back to this, focus on this, the fun.
Yes, absolutely.
What did you get out of it?
Well, it was actually related to you picked out of it, which was when he was saying that the fun has decreased a bit for him as he's got older and as his career has matured, that he's lost some of that magic and wonders about how to get it back. And it's also something that I've thought about. And just recently, I have got some of the magic back, and it got me thinking about why. And I think a lot of the time, I've been not writing to brief exactly, but writing to trope. I've thought, okay, I like this genre of fiction and I would like to write within this genre of fiction. And that genre has certain rules and certain beats and certain tropes that you have to hit. And you've got to go forth and do those things, which can be satisfying in itself. But as I've done more and more and more of it, I have lost some of that energy and momentum. And just recently, I've been writing a book which was purely a story that I wanted to tell. just something that I was excited about, just purely without thinking about the market or how it would be received or what's currently doing well or anything like that. Just what story do I want to tell right now? And that has given me so much energy and momentum. So maybe that can be helpful to someone.
And Fiona, I'm curious because you write you write different projects at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Are you coming to that project with more energy than your other product? Your other projects?
Yes, funny enough. The thriller that I'm writing, although it's going well and I'm happy with what I'm producing, I'm not coming to the page with that same kind of rubbing my hands together with glee, oh yay, I want to get on with this. But when I get to the one that is just purely the story I want to tell, yes, there is that glee, and it's occupying my mind more even when I'm not writing. I'm thinking about it during the day.
Fiona, I feel like you've got a big lesson for me there. I'm going to have to think about that, take that home and use it. What other advice do you have for me today?
Oh, goodness. I can tell you about something I've been struggling with. Funny enough, with this project, which is the thing I'm so excited about, but I've had a fear that I haven't had since I was a real baby writer, which is the fear of running out of words. That I've got enough words for maybe 15,000 words, but I don't have enough words for 80,000 words. Or I can manufacture the words, but I don't have the story to sustain 80,000 words. And that makes me do the thing that I think I talked about last week, which is procrastinate on the page. Avoid getting to the meat of the story because you're afraid of running out of meat.
And tell me, where are you in that project? What's your word count?
I think I'm hitting 15,000 words now.
Okay.
And I've had this fear all along. And the only advice I can give people is what I'm giving myself, which is don't stay away from the meat. Get right into it. Don't be afraid of running out of stuff. Because when you are getting into the heart of the story, it gains a kind of momentum which keeps you going. And you realize, oh, there's more stuff, and there's more, and there's more.
Magic that Ivan talked about can happen in the meat of the story.
Yes, yes. So don't be scared of the meat. Get right into it. You're not going to run out of ideas.
Very good advice. And my advice this week is maybe a little bit related, that when you're struggling, that one of the ways back to the page is to do the part that you love. So I love writing dialogue. And I find it easier than the rest. So often when I really am struggling to know where I'm going or what I'm doing, I will manufacture a situation where I can write some dialogue. And then often the characters will, and it's that mad thing that happens, the characters will throw something into the dialogue that shows me where I'm going or ups the pace or makes it more exciting. You know, it often then does run away for itself. For me, it happens in dialogue. I think for other people, it might happen in other types of writing, whether it's the scene setting or the exposition or whatever it is that you enjoy the most. I think it is a way back into the page when you are struggling.
So your advice is not that thing that I think it was Helen Moffat said, write your favorite bits first.
No,
skip ahead in the story and find some dialogue to write. You saying create a situation where there will be dialogue.
I actively, with the greatest of respect to people who do it like that, and everyone has their own process, I actively will not allow myself that. I will skip ahead to the dessert, because then what am I going to write towards, first of all? And secondly, stories change as you tell them. And if you write the end at the beginning, I know the end very often, but it changes as you're writing. And I would hate to have committed myself. I'm very lazy, remember. I would hate to have committed myself to one ending and then either have to throw it away or work towards that. But also, very often for me, what's compelling the writing is knowing where I'm going and that I'm going to get to write that scene.
So I would never
write out of order. Never, ever.
Yeah. And some people do it and it works for them, but I am not one of those writers.
Absolutely not.
So we want everyone to check out Ivan Vladislavich's memoir, The Near North. It's published by Pan Macmillan. It's in all bookstores right now. If you don't see it, ask for it by name. And we hope you'll check out his backlist too, because it's fascinating. So much rich material there. And we hope you will get in touch. We're on all social media across the board, and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.